Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the man that murdered the king. Viva la revolution. Duncan Nichols.
Duncan, I've gotten so good at that new intro. I used to have to do so many takes to not stumble over it completely.
Don't phrase yourself too much. I did have to correct you and remind you to do it.
You weren't supposed to tell the audience that. Okay, that's true. Hello, everyone.
Welcome to this week's episode of Is This Just Fantasy? We're talking about Brian McClelland's The Promise of Blood, the first in the Powder Maid trilogy.
Speaking of errors, Duncan and I were saying to each other back and forth for maybe a full 30 seconds, McClelland, not McKellen, as we said in a previous episode.
I feel very much shame about that. I just can't get Ian out of my head.
Sorry, Brian.
But yes.
Yeah, Brian, Ian, even the first names are similar.
There's a conspiracy theory in that. But, Geordie, before we get into this book, let's just go over, as usual, have you read or watched or experienced anything else you want to talk about?
Funnily enough, yes. It hasn't actually been that long since we recorded our previous episode, not the full 2 weeks as normal. However, I have actually started reading something new and interesting. I've recently been doing a lot more, and this is quite unusual for me. I've been reading more non-fiction.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu, indeed. Yeah, not like me at all. But I've been listening to, and this has been a long, long reading experience. It's like three times the length of Dune. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by, someone. I'll edit that in.
William L. Schreier.
And the book Mindhunter, which is the inspiration for the TV show. A TV show that I love, it's great. And the book is quite different, but it's really interesting nonetheless.
That is very different. I suppose it, just to be clear, it takes a very much an anti-it-was-a-bad-thing stance.
The Third Reich? Yes, Duncan. It's very opposed to the Third Reich.
Good. Just gotta check. Gotta check on these things.
Yeah. Actually, the funny thing I noticed about it is that when I was reading the early part of the book, I was like, holy shit, this is the source for everything I was reading during, like, year 10 history. Like, I recognize these sources almost verbatim.
Well, that's always fun. If you find, like, the key text, everyone's like, okay, we're going to reference this.
Yeah, it's a really significant text because the guy himself who wrote it, and again, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. Here it is again.
William L. Schreier.
He was an active journalist living in Berlin during, like, the rise of Hitler in the Second World War. So not only does it contain, like, his memories of hearing actual speeches, like, at the Reichstag, but, like, his personal diary entries that he can go back through and remember what he was thinking, like, in the lead up to Kristallnacht.
That is very intense, but I do think it's actually can be very good to read about real world history, particularly when we enjoy so much fantasy literature that is either inspired by real events or set to certain backdrops. Sometimes to see sort of the real world implications of certain ideologies, mm-hmm. and what can actually happen. So many times, you know, there's a rhetoric about, you know, that's fantastical or that's ridiculous, and you're like, I think you'll find some truly insane stuff has actually happened in real life.
That, I mean, there's no question of that. And the best thing about it is that, like, this author is really focused on the boring stuff. Like, there are lengthy sections where he just talks about what different German and Russian and British diplomats are doing, like, in the lead up to World War II. Like, this material is, like, extremely dry. It's all about people setting up meetings and, like, the minutes taken from meetings and what people claim happened later when they talk about it at Nuremberg. And they say, I never actually went to that meeting. That's nonsense. But this guy is clearly so invested in making sure that this is recorded and that it's commented on that it's really fascinating.
I mean, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. I take it you recommend it?
It's hard to say recommended. Again, so I'm listening to this as an audiobook, and I think that's the only way I could possibly read this. There's no way. I mean, I could probably scarcely lift the book. The audiobook is 52 hours long, and Dune was 24 hours long, to give you an example of comparison.
I mean, I think my longest audiobook I have on Audible is The Way of Kings, and I think that comes in at like 40 something, 46, 48.
That's not a surprise.
So that is incredible. Geordie, I feel really kind of awkward right now because I've now got to segue over to what I've been reading, and it's tonally quite different.
Oh, because yours was, hey, Nazism was great, actually.
No, no, no. It's more that yours is very serious and mine is very ridiculous. Geordie, have you ever heard of the character Groove the Wanderer?
I have not heard of Groove the Wanderer.
He is a comic book character by a Spanish-Mexican comic book writer and artist, Sergio Aragonés. I'm so sorry, I probably definitely pronounced that wrong. And I guess you can describe it as a Conan parody at some point, but it's a larger parody for life, and it's about a very stupid character who's like a barbarian figure, fights with like dual swords. He has a little dog companion called Roberto, and it's just stupid adventure parody, parodying fantasy, parodying real world politics, parodying religion. But so it has like really clever commentary at some points, and it also has some really just stupid bits of our main character who is in the search for the world's greatest cheese dip. And at one point, to stop him causing a ruckus, the priests, what they do, they write a sign pointing the greatest cheese dip in the world, and they just put them round a lake, and he just walks in circles for multiple days.
Well, that does sound a little silly, I have to admit.
It's genuinely, it's like if, I guess, Asterix and Obelisk met, I don't know, the Beano.
I did get a slightly asterisk feel to that story, especially the cheese dip thing, because when I was a little boy, my dad would, like, this is before I even learned to read, but he would prop me up next to him and he would read me the Asterix stories. And one of my most favorites was like Asterix in Switzerland. And there's a bit in that where it was a very lengthy, like, callback joke to these Romans doing an absolutely ginormous cheese fondue, like in a huge cauldron that could contain a person.
I mean, yes, that is exactly at home in these comics. And his dog companion is just like Nasher, if Nasher had an eternal voice, from Dennis the Menace. And I don't know why I'm like, I love them so much, but there was a crossover with Conan once. And the way that the artist decided to do it is that the comic was framed with the meta-narrative of him trying to pitch the idea to, like, the comic, the board of governors at Dark Horse, and then being like, that's so stupid, and him going, no, wait.
Okay.
And then all the artwork is done so that the Conan sections are done super, like, realistic and invoking that early, like, first 50 issues of the Dark Horse era.
Which are really
good. Which are amazing, written by Kurt Busiek and Carrie Nord. I'm so sorry for saying your names wrong.
I'm pretty sure it's Busiek, isn't it?
Probably.
Maybe.
Apologies again. Anyway, they're really stupid. And if you love, like, the Beano or Conan and just want to see that sort of take on, like, a fighting character, go have fun. There are a load of them on Kindle. It's really actually hard to find the older stuff, I will say. That it's, like, not available digitally.
What is the like older stuff, issues. Like the 80s?
I believe the character debuted, no, in the early 90s.
Okay.
I think the biggest run was in, like, the mid-90s with Marvel for, like, 120 issues. Then he sort of went dead throughout the noughties. And then since the 10s, there's been sort of a consistent Dark Horse have the license. And they're kind of putting out, instead of, like, a continuous comic book series, they'll do, like, 4 issues a year, and then that'll get collected in a trade for that year. And that'll be like one complete story arc. I recommend just stupid fun. What isn't just stupid fun, though, and has some genuinely smart ideas, is Promise of Blood.
Hooray! But we're on to it. Okay, so this is a book series that is, it's a classic genre, not of book, but of the narrative around books, which is that Geordie Bailey hears about it on Reddit a lot, and yet doesn't know anything about it except that people seem to like it. And he knows what books it tends to get compared to.
Interesting. I don't think I'm as aware of that. I assume it's in a very similar space to the Joe Abercrombie, the Mark Lawrence.
Yes, absolutely.
I would say Brandon Sanderson, but everyone just seems to recommend Brandon. I've seen genuine posts where people are like, I really enjoyed The Wizard of Earthsea. What do you recommend? And people go, Brandon Sanderson. I'm like, that's not what?
Yeah, that's it's like One Piece among manga fans. It's like, if someone likes One Piece, they will let you know. That and JoJo.
But yeah, I assume, so am I right then? Those are kind of the classic comparisons.
You're dead on the money. That's what they compare it to. And also, anytime someone's like, I want a slightly different take on magic and technology, they go straight to the Powder Mage. And I found out why. Right from the start, I don't really know why, but just knowing that it was about wizards and gunpowder, I think something about that, some part of me was just immediately like, I don't know about this. Even not really knowing what it entailed, I just was set up at once to be a bit anti it. So the book had to clear a bit of a hurdle right away. Because I was like, oh, I don't know if I like these ideas. I don't know if I think they're going to mesh. And also, I think it goes to a slightly industrial punk, like Victorian energy, which I'm very wary of. I feel like so many people go to that well as a sort of plentiful aesthetic, thinking of Dishonored and the Gutter Prayer especially. And I've been burnt by those so many times, especially by someone like the Gutter Prayer. So I was really worried it was going to be like that.
It is a little bit of a dark saying. I love Dishonored, and I do really enjoy this aesthetic, personally. And I told you, you know, when we read the Gutter Prayer, I was like, I'm prepared to forgive it a lot because I kind of like the vibe. I think my only reservation, my fear, is that it almost seemed too, I don't know, is it edgy? Is it too much like, because I'm a big fan, talking about like musketry. I love the Sharks book by Bernard Cornwell.
Yeah.
Adore them. But they were very much my teenage years. And I think that's just given a slight coloration to anything else set in that entire era. I know it's unfair and a bit silly of me, but that's kind of where I was also coming from. Of like, this sat on my like to read list. I've owned this book, Geordie, for like 3 years. I've just never quite gotten around to it. It's like, I knew I wanted to buy it because I knew I wanted to read it, but never
yeah,
quite...
Yeah, 2012. It's not a new book.
Yeah, it never quite got to the top of my list. There was always something that I was just a little bit more interested in, or I was like, oh, yeah, I'll read that later. Let's try this out instead. But we've got the podcast. I wanted to get around to it. I wanted to share it with you, experience it together. Geordie, before we kind of explain the actual premise of the book and, you know, what's going on, what did you think? Come on, you had the premonitions, you were a bit worried. Did it manage it? Did it win you over?
For the most part, I really like this book. There's a lot of stuff in here that's a winner for me. It's not a slam dunk, it's not a home run, but it's a really good book and I enjoyed it a great deal.
I couldn't agree more. This book I really enjoyed because I loved so many elements of it. And I'm going to throw this phrase out there like immediately, because this was generally my first thought when I finished the book. And by the way, I appreciate this is part of a trilogy. We are just judging the first book as it stands at the first bit, because one, that's all we've read. And also, I do think it's fair enough to judge a book as a complete package, because that's what you paid for.
For sure. But you choose whether to continue the series or not based on whether the first one was good.
I would, generally, my golden phrase for this book is that it wasn't quite greater than the sum of its parts. But the sum of its parts is still really high. That makes sense.
I kind of see what you're going for there. I would describe it as a book with so many really great elements, but is let down by a couple of disappointments. Stuff that I expect. Sort of similar stuff to what weighed down something like Malice by John Gwynne. But less so, much less so, like in much smaller amounts than Malice. So, for example, it's a long book. Maybe longer than it needs to be. I kind of like some of the parts which are, like, really long. Maybe there are too many characters, just like in Malice by John Gwynne. Maybe it's a little bit misogynistic in parts, and like, not maliciously, but just sort of by default. Similar issues to something like Malice by John Gwynne.
It certainly sits, and I know this is a very wide scale, but it definitely sits above my enjoyment for Malice, but I couldn't let go of the fact that it wasn't quite hitting Best Served Cold. I was like, it's not. It's just not quite clinching it. And it's not only in the moment to moments, but also how it all came together.
So Malice by John Gwynne, I think, was second to last in all of the books we read in our top 50. And Best of Cole was between like 3 and 5. So that's of the top. So that's a pretty big range.
And it falls definitely somewhere in between. But let me explain to the readers who may, listeners, sorry, who maybe have not read this book. The Powder Maze trilogy is the story of a magical land where a god has left thousands of years ago, and before he left, he established 9 dynasties to rule over the 9 realms. Kingship, magic, and goodness. This is the story of where the land has got to that kind of industrial revolution. Gunpowder has become a thing, and all the power no longer sits in the hands of kings and their circle of magicians. This story opens where one man has had enough. And with his powder mages, who are different to magicians, we'll talk about that more later, like traditional magic users, him and his guards of musket men storm the palace, kill all the wizards, capture the king, and form a republic. Viva la revolution.
That's right. So you say in industrial age, and we should be very precise, this is pre-industrial. It's very, very much drawn on the... It's very much drawn on the era of French Revolution. Like, that's when we are. We're in the 1770s. So, like, the industrial age is, like, 40, 50 years from now. It's coming up fast, but it's not quite here yet.
And this is the kickoff. This is the opening chapter. And then from there, we kind of follow 3 principal POV characters. My personal favourite, the character of Thomas, who is the man who led the revolution.
That's right.
Who now sits at the top. He controls the powder mages. He controls the military in this land. We follow the character of Adamant, who is a detective hired by Tamis to unravel some of the last mysteries of the wizards. What are they called in this?
The Royal Cabal
is what the groups are. The Privileged. Great bit on the nose, but
yes, a bit on the nose. That's the first problem I had with this book. Very Hunger Games, but we'll come back to that later. We got Adamant, as you say, he's the detective. There's a mystery in this book, and he's the main perspective character for that.
And the final one, Taniel?
Yes, Taniel. Like Daniel with a T.
And he is Tamas's son, and he, I'm not going to lie, for the opening bits of this story, doesn't quite know what he's doing, but eventually he is sent off on a faraway quest to hunt down the last of the privileged in the kingdom, a man who unfortunately is also Taniel's best childhood chum. And he gets on a... His story is probably the most twisty-windy. He goes on the most traditional quest.
Yes, he goes on a quest, and his is very, very action-focused. And actually, now, there are more perspective characters. Like, there's this one lady who's like a maid, and she bears witness, and she provides an important perspective for some of the book as a representative of the royalists as opposed to the revolutionaries. But it's noteworthy as we are telling this story. I'm like, okay, this is a lot of perspective characters. All of them are men so far. I wonder if you're going to get a feminine perspective. Okay, here's our one female character. She has far, far fewer chapters than the men. All right, but she doesn't really have that much to do in the story. She's kind of a minor player. And now she's vanished for a really big portion of the book. And she's back. Yeah, she's back at the end. And now her story's getting exciting. She's really going to make a decisive decision within the plot. And, I guess it didn't really actually matter. Like, she didn't really have any agency in the end. And she vanishes. And her fate is uncertain by the end of the book. Okay, well, that was a bit weird, wasn't it?
Summed up beautifully. It's one of those little plot elements which, on the one hand, I'm like, you could have cut this. But I know it's in here because this probably is going to be a bigger thing in the sequel. If I had to guess?
Probably. A lot of setup. Not a lot of really interesting stuff going with her. Such to the point, I do not remember her name.
It's Neela.
Neela, thank you, Duncan. So yes, we have these different point of view characters to provide us not only different perspectives on what's going on the unfolding of this revolution, but actually each character can provide like a different type of drama. So Tamas is a field marshal. So previously he was a really important figure within the country's military, and now he's a revolutionary, and now he's doing politics. You know, he is still doing field marshal stuff. He's leading troops. He's directing stuff. But actually, most of the stuff that comes across his desk tends to be just like, oh man, I can't piss off this faction, and I have to deal with these threats from outside, and I need to make these big decisions, and I have to balance my moral code against what I have to do for the greater good. So that's a lot of interesting drama. Again, like you, I think Tamas was my favorite character in this book. He's very well written. And then you get a different experience where you say Adamant is going to be this detective character. There's a mystery, and he is the one who's going to go out and, like, puzzle around. Okay, great. So settings like this, like fantasy and historical books, they gel really well with mysteries, because mysteries are evergreen stories. In any time period, the past, the present, the future, in the fantastical, in the strange, in the nonsensical, so much of actual just regular storytelling is about mysteries. You can ask J.J. Abrams about that and his mystery boxes. So a detective is a great character to follow wherever you are. It just makes sense.
It does, and it also gives you the opportunity, because he's interviewing like all these different characters, you can then get loads and loads of perspectives in.
That's true.
And different insights to a huge cross-section of people that are living in this society. So that's amazing. And then you have Tanil. And I really want to say it like... What? Tanil. That's what I said.
You said Tanil.
That's not what I said. Tanil. And I really wanted to see, like, kind of off the cusp, because here's one. God, he was not my favourite. By a long shot.
Yeah, I enjoyed a lot of his chapters. I liked the fight scenes he was in. But it was a bit repetitive. Like, I could only see that guy snort gunpowder so many times. And we'll get into how fucking cool it is that you have these people who just eat and smoke gunpowder to get their magic. But yeah, I feel like that character goes the most in circles. And I like the fact that he's, like, actually a part of, like, a sustained war campaign and not just doing one-off adventures. Like, he's actually, like, holding the line somewhere and he has a lot of places to go. That's all good stuff. But nonetheless, as you say, definitely not quite as interesting as the other two.
So, Geordie, sometimes I feel like when you have a book that's very mixed or, like, very good with some minor faults, that's actually, like, the hardest one for me to sit here and critique. Because I don't want to, like, oversell it and be like, oh, this is why it's awful. But also, so much of what I maybe didn't enjoy in this book, it's very subtle. It can be a little sense of, like, well, that scene just... the pacing in that scene was just a bit off. Or that character was a bit extraneous. Or elements where it's like, oh, well, that didn't quite gel together. All these plot threads, just too many plots were left hanging that I didn't really feel... that this book worked on its own. And it's really challenging to now recount to someone listening why I didn't love it, while at the same time wanting to be like, oh no, I still enjoyed it. You should give it a go.
Yeah, it is difficult because I want to give this book its fair shakedown, both in terms of the stuff I really liked and the stuff that I felt like it could have improved upon. I really want to make clear, way more good stuff than bad. It can be really easy in doing a critique to focus in on the bad stuff, because that's what you can get energized about. So I really want to start, I think, before we're mean to this book and we talk about some of the stuff in it that's a bit of a letdown, we should hone in on some of the cool shit first and really give it the enthusiasm it deserves. So Duncan, could you just talk to me about what is a powder mage and why is it very, very cool?
Powder mages are a subset of magic users in this world. And what makes them... firstly, this book outright says no one really knows why powder mages work. That we don't understand their magic. It's different to traditional magic. They just can. And what they do is they enter the powder trance. When they either digest or snort gunpowder, they go into this hyper state where they can move quicker, their reflexes are faster, their healing's improved. But what's more is that they can ignite sources of gunpowder that they can, like, sense in their surrounding. Mm-hmm. And not only can they ignite it, but they can take, like, the blast power of, like, from gunpowder and, like, redirect it.
Yeah, they control kinetic energy. So they can reshape explosions. They can take the energy that is expressed by igniting gunpowder and just redirect it, push it elsewhere. This is first demonstrated when the king tries to just shoot Tamas with a gun, and Tamas just senses the explosion in the gun, and he takes the energy from behind the bullet and just moves it over to a floor tile. The floor tile explodes, and the bullet just rolls out of the barrel.
And this is used in so many creative ways that is a very sense of, I don't know, this is a great film to be referencing. You ever seen Wanted?
No. Is that the one about curving bullets?
Yeah.
Yes, there's a lot of curving bullets in this. And what I do like about this, I like this a lot, even though the actual repertoire of Power to Mages is pretty limited, they have, like, basically two powers. They go into a super state where they're just better at being a human fighter than other people, and they can control kinetic energy from explosions. But all of the characters we see, and whose perspective we see, so Tamas and Taniel and Gloria? Glora?
Isn't it V? Isn't it Vlora?
Vlora? I listened to the audiobook. All right, so whatever her name is, Vlora, Gloria, so all three of them have, like, different ways of fighting with gunpowder. Tamas's deal is that he's really good at, like, controlling a lot of objects. So I think there's a bit where he basically just, like, he throws a bunch of bullets into the air, ignites a ton of gunpowder, and just, like, redirects all the bullets so they scatter out and hit a bunch of people. But Taniel's deal is that, like, he's basically a sniper, and his deal is he's so good at controlling bullets in their flight that he can turn them through multiple people by wobbling them in the air. And Vlora or Glora or whatever her name is can ignite gunpowder from, like, really, like, triple the range that she should be able to. So she can cause massive explosions far away.
One of the things I really like about Taniel's power is they make it really clear that when it comes to going up against, like, traditional magic users, the privileged, well, they can summon huge balls of fire and fling them through the air. But the thing is, they have nothing to be just be hit by a bullet at long range. They don't know it's coming. And I love this idea of this guy, like, yeah, I just snipe them. The most dangerous, most powerful people in the world. And they have no idea that death's even coming for them.
Exactly, because they have powers at close range. They can make walls of stone, and they can harden the air. So when they know you're coming, if you're just, like, showing up with them with, like, a flintlock pistol, you're in trouble. But if they don't know it's coming, there's a bit later where, like, he sort of almost accidentally kills, like, the most powerful wizard in, like, in the land of Kez. And he doesn't know, because he's so far away he can barely see him. He just, bam, he blasts him. And they're like, dude, do you know who you just fucking shot?
And anyone who's a fan of Bernard Martial Arts books will appreciate a good rifleman. And I loved the fact that although they have these magical powers, they're still using some of those terminologies, you know. They're still getting guys to form up in lines occasionally. They're still fixing bayonets and going in.
Yeah, so I actually don't have as much experience with, like, musketry in books. I haven't read the Sharp novels. I have failed completely to read the Master and Commander books. I just can't do it. I'm sorry, I can't. I can't read about knots for so long. Yeah, I don't. I just haven't really developed that same appreciation.
Okay, a few quick shots at some amazing historical fiction. Master and Commander books, they're amazing series. They are very different to the Sharps. Sharps, it's more kind of feels like James Bond at points. Like, Bernard Cornwell knows how to write good action. You've got a hero. He's going on very over-the-top adventures quite a lot of the time, but still a really good appreciation for history. Master and Commander, that's the name of the first book. I can't remember the name of the whole series. That is like Jane Austen at points. It's like, I'm going to show you everything this naval officer does, from get his promotion and wonder who he needs to go and, like, write a letter to first, his aunt or his uncle, and, like, all the way through to hiring the doctor, picking up supplies, doing knots, and, like, actually running a ship. And then we'll have brief moments of genuine combat, and it's, like, amazing action, and characters that you've literally seen at, like, dinner parties die, and then it goes back to, like, normal. It's incredibly, like, it's like an unedited, this is the life of like a naval seaman.
The book series is called The Aubrey and ASS's Maturin novels.
Yes, that's the captain, the commander, and the ship's surgeon.
Mm.
They're like, it's that classic captain and doctor relationship. In fact, it might be one of the best, actually, in fiction. Of like the one guy who will talk back to the captain when he thinks he's doing too much, and their talks on like philosophy.
Hey, we have one of those in this book.
Oh, everyone got to get from somewhere.
So Tamas and his bodyguard. I'm realizing how much of these characters' names I've forgotten. I did enjoy this book, but I also read this like a couple of weeks back while I was hiking through Sweden, so maybe my brain got a bit frazzled.
Olam,
yes. Their relationship, very enjoyable.
So Olam is, so we've got to spell another cool magic thing. So there's like three tiers of magic users in this world.
Four.
You've got the powder mages, they're like mid-tier. Then you have top tier is the privileged, they're the traditional wizards. And the lowest level are the knacked. These are people that just have one special ability.
Mm.
And in here we see a couple of characters with them. We see Olam, who just doesn't need to sleep. Very useful when you're a bodyguard. And we also see other characters that have like perfect memories. I'm trying to think of actually what's another one off the top of my head.
One person is implied to be able to tell truth from lies, but then he's lied to and he doesn't realize it. So I don't know what the hell is going on there.
And I think the idea is that these people, some of the NACT are like kind of just useless. But yeah, if you've got a really handy one, you can be as, I guess, proficient as like a full powder mage. It just depends on what your knack is. But yes, Olam, love this relationship, because the idea is Tamas, he's commander of the military, he's just executed all the upper classes, and I think a lot of people do get the vibe of like he might just execute us, like he doesn't, we know he won't.
Well,
we know Tamas.
So the thing about the character of Tamas, we've talked about him in the abstract and like the role he plays in the story and what his like the decisions he has to make are, we actually talked about his character. And what makes Tamas enjoyable is that, one, he does play the role of grizzled, experienced commander. But he's also, deep down, kind of brattish and immature. He's a grizzled, angry man. And he's completely ruled by his passions a huge amount of the time. So most of the conflict he faces is internal. It's him vying with what he wants to do, which is often to lose his shit and kick a table, with what he has to do, which is be responsible and give commands when lives are on the line.
This is actually shown to us really succinctly in the very first chapter, I believe, where someone's like, are you just doing this because your wife got executed? And it's literally his, like, in his thoughts, it just goes, yes. And then he says, no, I am doing this for the rights of the people and the revolution. And that just tells you everything. Like, he is actually doing this for very personal reasons. He got pissed off. He was wrong personally. So he's going to kill the people responsible.
Exactly.
If that means saving the nation, that is obviously amazing. And that's what he wants to do. But at the start of this book, he is saving the nation while fulfilling his own personal goals. And a lot of this book is him trying to reconcile when those two things start to diverge. What's he going to do?
Yeah. And what we get behind here is that book is about social change. Fundamentally, you know, we have these characters who provide a perspective on like the different factions at play, and they have their little adventures and they're fighting people and they're shooting their guns, pew 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 pew. But really what this book is about is from transition away from the power of royalty, and it does this in a fantasy novel. So there are plenty of historical novels you can read, and not even historical, lots of sci-fi novels and dystopian novels are about overthrowing a corrupt system. And sometimes you get those in fantasy as well, but they tend to be about the wrong person's on the throne. Let's put the right person on the throne, the rightful heir, or maybe a more worthy heir. That's what, you know, Children of Blood and Bone ended up being, right?
In many respects, this book gets to the best idea of Blood and Bone immediately, which is, once you overthrow the tyrant, what now? And it's really fun to see a book which is just going to focus on that. It's just going to go, we killed the king. Crap. What do you do? What do you replace it with? Because it's not, you know, the world isn't as simple as, oh, well, you've got two choices, complete dictatorship or you know, traditional modern democracy. Mm-hmm. Not like there's only one form of that. There's so many ways this can fall out. And
exactly,
it's really nice to see them struggle with it, and that it's hard.
And that marries really well with the character of Adamant. So Tamas has the struggle of, I'm responsible for what's happened. I led the revolution, which means everything that falls subsequently is on me. So when there's a royalist civil war brewing within the city, he has to be responsible for putting it down. But the complexity of there are all these different factions which supported Tamas and his powder mages in their coup, and now they're the new power. You have like a group of mercenaries, you have the unions. It's really weird to read a fantasy novel where so much of a book is about unions.
No, I loved it. The workers' unions and like what powers they're going to have and what role they're going to play. And that Tamas promised a lot of people, well, I don't think it's he personally, but like they all kind of had these ideas of what they were going to get.
That's right.
Once they took power.
Yeah, Tamas's second chapter is like the previous, I think, mayor or something similar to a mayor is like, okay, now about all of those powers you were going to give me. Tamas is like, okay, well, I'm giving you like a third of the money I said I was going to give you. And he's like, what? But that's not what we agreed. I'm like, yeah, but the church just said I have to pay them more. So what do you want?
It's really nice. Okay, I'm going to reference something now, which seems a bit stupid. This was a very bad example of trying to do this. Geordi, did you ever play Fable 3 when you were a kid?
I've never played a single Fable game.
Fable 3 is a video game, came out on the Xbox 360, probably the PC as well. And the whole first part of the game is that you're leading a revolution. And then the whole second part of the game, I say second part, latter fifth, is the fact that then you're king and you're like, okay, oh no, there's like an external threat and I need to like build up a super military to combat it. Well, I might not be able to fulfill all my promises while maintaining a giant army.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do I do?
The horror of leadership. And what's the great thing about it is that Tamas, in his words, says, I led the revolution, but I'm not actually interested in leading. That's up to the council. You know, the council that he appointed and he put together, and where all of them look to him for guidance, and who he takes unilateral decisions away from. And this is not the book being, like, unaware that the main character is, like, the most important person. He gets to make all the big decisions. No, this is obviously a really deliberate choice. Tamas is really, really close to just being a dictator. Like, he's the one with the power. No one else in the country in Adapest has an army to compete with him. The only person who can is the church, because they have, like, the most sway over the people. And there's also a mercenary army, but I don't think it's ever actually presented as, like, a proper, like, actual threat. Like, there's a genuine chance of them, like, fighting against Adapest at this juncture, at least.
I think the general vibe is he knows that if he gets drawn into that sort of civil war, it will just leave him, he'll probably win it, but he'll leave him too open to basically anyone else to rock up.
Well, forget that. That's not what's important. What's important is that that choice puts him in a position of just being the new king. Okay, the king is dead. Well, guess what you got now? You have a Napoleon Bonaparte.
And it's interesting that he's actually still very likable.
He sure is. He likes his dogs, he's good to his men, and he has a great relationship with his bodyguard. Like, he's very entertaining to read about.
And it's really fun to read about his frustrations, because when he's dealing with the politicking and trying to balance things, and it's both cathartic when he sometimes snaps and is like, I'm just doing this.
Yeah, I'm cutting through the bullshit.
But then also at the same time, you're like, oh, that's another step on like that dark path.
Absolutely. So many heroes are promised by like the evil sorceress or the bad, or the Darth Vader, you know, I can give you power if only you would join me. And it just doesn't sell, because it's really hard to just abstractly say, yes, my character wants power. People want power to do things. They want to change the world in some significant way. And often, when those offers are given, it feels like the character is never going to accept this bargain because they don't want power that much. They don't want to compromise themselves just to get power. No one just wants power. But what Tomas wants isn't power. Tomas wants to get the job done. He wants to get things set straight. He wants to get the people fed and the roads built and to get the trains to run on time. And oh no! Oh no!
This is a fantastic part of the novel. And I'll be really honest with you, Geordie. There is not an insignificant part of me that kind of wishes this was just the third, you know, one third the length book I was reading. I think it's really strong.
I do hear what you're saying. I do. Because it is the strongest part, and it's the part that's most enjoyable, and I'm really relieved when I get back to a Tamas chapter. And I'm not against the Adamat chapters. I think they are engaging enough mysteries, which I don't think stand by themselves, so it's good that they're connected to another one. And I like Taniel's gunplay adventures. They're cool and exciting, and, you know, they feel like something out of, like, just a straightforward action heroic sword and sorcery story more than anything, or maybe like a pulp sci-fi story with ray guns. His deal is he's fighting essentially, like, you said there were three types of wizards. There's actually four, maybe five, depending on how you stretch it, because there is a group called the...
Predii,
the Predii. And the Predii are super privileged. We didn't actually talk about how stupid the name privileged is. The wizards in the world are called privileged. And I guess he chose this because he was like, I really want you to just get the message. And I don't want to come up with a silly fantasy word which means privileged, blessed by the gods. But also, it's just a bit stupid, isn't it? It feels like cringy YA stuff.
I would have been equally as happy with, like, magi, magicians, sorcerers, wizards. I thought probably would sound a little dopey, but the same vibe would have come across. Or just go for another, come off of the Predii name, be like the Predae or the
Scions.
I'll just call them the wizards. That's what they are. We all know it.
Yeah, so the wizard nobility, what was I just saying? Yeah, so there's a super wizard nobility, the Predii, who existed before the main privileged, and they are immortal, and they're crazy powerful, and there's two of them in this book that is just stomping the shit out of each other.
Yeah, and they're good action scenes, and there's a lot of, you know, big magic going off, and there's a great scene at a university where a tower gets blown up.
But not blown up, and it's sliced in two. And then it falls down and Tanya has to be like, ah, and jump out.
Yeah, and he goes smashing through the roof of another building. It's really hard because this is genuinely really fun action we're describing. I love how he's jumped over Adamant, but we're on Tanya, so we're going to talk about him. He has these cool action scenes, and he also has some genuinely good character stuff. There's so many elements in this book that it's hard to kind of keep up with. He's got an ex-wife who he came back from war and found in the bed of another man, but oh no, his dad really likes her, and she's a member of the Powder Mages as well.
That's right.
So his dad's like, come on, can't you just get back together? And he's like, how could I? And I'm like, yeah, fair dues. And then also he has this new friend who we think is like 14.
Yeah,
and
Capole.
Then just when he starts to get like romantic interest, they turn him and go, actually, I'm 18. And you go, thank God for that.
Yes. So
that was creepy and unnecessary.
Yeah, that was... Okay, so now we're on to maybe... So this is a part of the book which is just so annoyingly bad. From first and foremost, it's just... Just why? Just why? Like, it's so... It feels like such an obvious blunder. Don't make your one of your main heroes, who I believe is 24 years old, and he's rocking around with his new assistant. He met her on like a war campaign, and she's his spotter. So it's her job to help mark targets so he can shoot them. And like she's useful to him because she's like a great tracker, and it turns out she has like weird magical powers, which are like not like the other privileged. And as we go along, you know, like... People start to make sort of jests about the two of them, And it's weird because you're like, okay, but you said from the start, she's mute, so she can't explain herself. It's said from the start that she's 15 years old. So it feels uncomfortable that people are making these jabs, like, so what's the two of you's relationship? A, wink, wink, and it's like, she's literally a child. And Tanya will say, she's a child, don't do that, that's gross. And you're like, yeah, good for you, Tanya, good for you for pointing that out. And then Tanya's like, now that Vlora's not here, what will I do? Maybe I'll marry Kapol. And I'm like, you think she's 15? Why are you saying that? That's weird.
This is a really weird, both like minor and like major part of the story. Because Kapol's relationship with Tanya is like quite a big bit of his plot. It might not take up that much actual page space, but it took up a lot of mind space when I was reading it. You know, I was thinking about this going, why are we doing it like this? It made me not like Tanya, like as much. Like really go, oh God, this guy again.
See, and that's weird. I never got to that point. I was never like, oh fuck, it's Tanya. I was always like, okay, let's see what Tanya's up to. I bet he's on a cool adventure.
See, I wasn't there. I was enjoying the adventure, but I couldn't actually bring myself to like love the adventurer. Tanya, I kind of got to the point where I'm like, oh, Tanya, dude, you're perving on a young person. You're dissing your dad a lot. And I know he's not been a great dad, but he's got a lot. I like Tamas. I'm on his side.
He has daddy issues. The problem I really have is that up until that point, like that one point where she says, she indicates with her hands, I'm 19. She's mute. She communicates with sign language. Up to that point, I really like their relationship. It's nothing groundbreaking, but it's just enjoyable, you know? You have these characters who, despite one of them having a disability, they're able to communicate. You have it where, like, she clearly cares about him a lot, but it feels like in, like, a way that he doesn't reciprocate because she's a kid and she looks up to him because, like, he's, like, a heroic person who saved her life and now they're, like, you know, they're comrades who've been in a foxhole together. And that's all really cool, interesting stuff. And then she goes, I'm 19. And the moment she communicates that, just a little switch flicks in. It just suddenly flicks in Tanya's head where it's like, okay, well, she's legal now. So now I can be interested in her sexually. And it feels weird.
It does. Particularly because I really felt like they were building this really good platonic, maybe, I'm not going to say master-student, maybe father-daughter, almost wolf and cub, not really quite that way.
Just pals, just friends.
Just pals, they're just war pals. Like, they've been through some really, you established that they went through some really hard shit together, and they've got each other's back to a ridiculous degree, and also that they're both really capable, but in drastically different ways. I really enjoyed that aspect as well. Like, one would not be as good without the other.
That's true.
As a team,
they're a great team. She's the tracker. He's the sniper. Like, she's literally his spotter.
So, I didn't like that. It was a bit of just a wet flannel over whatever kind of spark I was trying to get up with Tanya. And it just made me... The fact that he, as a character, has this kind of flicks... Like, he, as a character, has that moment. He just suddenly goes, oh, maybe I am interested in you in a different way. I was like, oh, dude, just go. Go on. I know your role in this, but I don't actually like you. I wouldn't want to go and have a drink with you. Just move along.
Shall we hit at some of the elements of the story which I don't think we've done their due diligence?
I mean, I think there's actually quite a lot. There's a lot of plot going on here.
It's a big book. And I actually really like the fact that it's quite a meandering story. When it first begins, you think it's going to be about, it's about picking up the pieces after revolution. And it is that for a bit. And now it's about a brewing civil war between royalists and republicans. And you're like, oh man, I guess this is the rest of a book. But actually, that's only like another quarter of the book. And then that's dealt with. And then it's about an upcoming invasion with Kez. And you're like, is this the rest of a book? Well, kinda. But actually, that's just like the lead into what's really going on, which is the revenge of the gods. The divine right of kings is real.
What a great concept. I actually love it. I love the fact that you're really using your fantasy world to empower our real world king's propaganda. Like, There've been real world revolutions.
Absolutely. Yeah, you play with... Yeah, what if the Divine Right of Kings is real is essentially the main basis. You could take out all the other magical elements and that would be the core one you keep, and it would be super interesting still.
Because now there's this big question, and, you know, Tamas puts it very bluntly at point, so does Tail. I think all of them actually put it quite bluntly at point, but they're just like, well, any god that was pro that crap system, fuck them. Please bleep that out. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Yeah, and you go from this kind of standard, you know, it's about people fighting people, and then it's about normal people fighting wizards, and the escalation of there's now a god out there and you're going to have to fight him, it feels really daunting. Like, you genuinely, I'm like, how the hell are these guys going to win? This feels impossible. Tamaths, have you damned your whole nation? There's two more books, so probably not, but maybe.
Close. It's a really fun concept. I really enjoyed earlier this year. I spoke about it on the podcast briefly, reading Unruly by David Mitchell, the British comedian, kind of going over the medieval kings of England. I loved in that book how ideas of like the divine right and some of the holy aspects of ceremonies, you can really track through English kings. And it's so interesting how in the real world, we literally know which people made up certain shit about the divine rights, and then like you flash forward five generations later and they're all kind of buying their own con. So to then take that and be like, okay, what then is the moral implication? If the king, it has a divine right, does that mean that they can do no wrong? Are you now doing wrong by opposing them? And then we get into fighting God.
Yeah, you've done an act of sacrilege by liberating your people.
I love fighting God. I like playing Final Fantasy games, and they all end in the same way. It's all at the end, you kill God. It's just how it's got to be done.
I also love climbing the steps of heaven and strangling God in his bed. It's my favorite thing to do, in fact.
I'm sorry, I don't know how to respond to that one.
That's our first t-shirt.
That it is. It's crazy, and I love the escalation to get there. Again, I really like the big picture stuff, and I think Tamas deals with a lot more of the big picture stuff. We've sort of missed something that did fall through the cracks there. So we talked about Tamas, talked about Tenil. They do have a father-son relationship, which just doesn't get enough page time for me to really become super interesting.
Yeah, they're not really together much at all.
Like, Tenil gets sent off very early on. I like the fact you did step on the fact that, you know, this is very much an evolving plot. Like, I talked about Tenil gets sent off to find, like, the last wizard. That's actually, like, his third mission. He goes on two quests beforehand, hunting a Predai and all of these other things. But let's talk about the other character, Adamant. Ah, the detective. Geordie, have you ever read Lowtown? I know you haven't, actually, so I don't know why I'm asking. Lowtown and the Straight Trilogy by Daniel Polansky. Straight Razor Cure is the first one. We will read it one day. God, this gave me such good Lowtown vibes. That is a detective in a very similar vibing setting. And I love it. I love the fact that when you've got a world with all the wizards and magic going on at that higher level, I love the fact that when you get down to like your day-to-day people, doesn't matter. It's kind of the same. Like that stuff, even for Tamas and like the Powder Mages, they're not the privilege, but they're still the elites. Like they hold a special place in society. They have special powers. They have taken power. They are now the ones at the top. And yet to the absolute bottom rung, very little difference.
I love the fact that in this book, like you have these revolutions going on, you have civil war brewing, an actual international war brewing, and people are talking about unions. People are talking about getting bread, you know? There's a real strong implication of the world does not stop for any of this. People need to keep living their lives. And that stands out the starkest in Adamant's section, because he's down with the people. He's not up in the castle for the most part. He's in the streets. He's attending boxing matches. And he's like visiting businesses and going to the library.
But yes, Adamant, so good detective. I really enjoy him. I really enjoy the fact that we get his family very early on.
Is he a good detective?
He is. Okay, is he a good one? He's a good guy who is a detective.
Because we've talked, yeah, he's a Gaffun perspective character.
Is he a good detective? Actually...
Like, and is it a good mystery?
Oh, that is a very good question.
What's the mystery, Duncan? Like, what is the act? There's two mysteries in this book. The first one is like, it's not a mystery at all, period. Like, it's a mystery box, like J.J. Abrams would say. There's nothing you can do to, like, solve it. You just have to wait for the plot to provide it. I like the parts where it's like, you're finding all these books where it's erased. That's cool. That feels like a conspiracy. That I like that a lot. That feels like a game of Delta Green, in fact. But you have, but then the actual mystery is, at a certain point, Tamas is alone in a room that only he knows about, and he's attacked by an enemy super soldier, basically. And he says, Adamat, only 5 people in the world, aside from me, know about this room. One of them plotted to kill me. I need you to find out who it is. And that leads Adamat to interview all of the main people on the council to try and determine their guilt and culpability.
And this is kind of interesting, because I mentioned this earlier. Like, we get him going around interviewing all these different people. He talks to the leader of the mercenaries. He talks to the leader of the church, the leader of the unions. But you're right. Is he a good detective? Because Adamant in this book doesn't really solve a single mystery. The first mystery, which is that kind of law mystery, we find out there's a mystery. They're like, oh, Kesmir, the god's promise has been broken. And literally, he reads some books, goes, someone's trying to hide it. And then he literally just goes and asks the guy. And the guy's like, oh, this is the answer, mate. You can go back and tell Tamas. There's nothing we, the reader, can do. This mm-hmm. bit is like a more traditional mystery. It's that Poirot.
This is a Hercule Poirot yes. style mystery. Locked room. You have to interview everyone. And you have to, identify who's telling lies. The difference is that when Poirot interviews people, he always discovers that they have secrets of their own. And he has to deduct each one. Okay, what are you hiding? And then reveal, like, oh, well, this is actually going on. That kind of happens a bit. Like, he finds out that, like, one of them, the mercenary leader, is, like, having an affair. But that doesn't actually impinge on any reason that she would, you know, want to overthrow Tamas. And, like, the union leader guy, he wants to expand unions worldwide. And, like, that means he wants to do business with the enemy nation of Kez. But I really just don't think, like, he doesn't intuit that. He's told that by other people.
Even the affair, I think he literally gets told by one of the other blokes when he's like leaving the thing. Some guy's like,
yeah,
they're still having an affair.
I seriously mean, he doesn't solve any of those mysteries. Like, he doesn't notice, like, oh, I happen to notice that you're wearing, you have the same perfume on. Perhaps you've been spending a lot of time together. It's nothing like that. He goes to other members of the council and you say, it's not me. It must be her. She's having an affair. Oh, it can't be me. It must be him. He's talking to Kez.
And not only that, but his impact then on the wider plot gets greatly diminished, because if he didn't solve this, like, there's a bit where he discovers that there's going to be an attempt on Tamas, which he only kind of discovers, I think, because someone attacks him. But anyway, and then he's like, I must rush to tell him. And then he's just too late. So it's like...
What he actually did, Duncan, was he found out who the conspirator was. You've mixed things up a bit. And the reason you mix things up is that we've kind of left a really important thing till last after this. He discovers that the Blackstreet Butchers, the Blackstreet Barbers, are going to assassinate the chef.
The street
dude.
Gang, by the way.
They're going to assassinate this cook because of religion reasons. And because he's claiming to be a god, and the church has hired assassins to kill him. And so what actually happens is Adamat rushes to the scene, and yes, he does arrive too late, but it's fine. And he tells Tamas, I know who did this. It was the church. I have proof. And that's the one bit of detective work he does, which is that he remembers by a description someone gives who an emissary of a church. There we go. It's the church who did it. Tamas goes rushing off to arrest the guy. And then Adamat discovers that it's a trap. The fact that he has exposed the mystery is leading Tamas to his death. The thing he's too late for is to arrive to warn Tamas that he's leading into a trap. He arrives after it's been sprung. and one black character in the book has been killed.
I mean, okay, yes. And I know that if he doesn't rush to the trap, you know, he's very important in the climax to take down one of the villains. But...
is he?
No, exactly.
He helps.
He helps a little bit. But he does feel like, other than letting him know, it was the church that tried to murder the guy calling himself a god, and you wouldn't have worked that out with it without me. What else does he... like, he doesn't achieve much. We learn a lot about the world because of what he does and what people tell him. And that's brilliant.
So he's a useful perspective character.
And he's fun.
But a story.
And that's why I really, weirdly, I prefer him to Tanil's sections, because I find him more fun to be with. You know, he has a family. He's a family man. They're threatened throughout quite a large section of this book. And, you know, I felt for him. I was there with him, even if he wasn't actually
competent. Yeah, for sure.
Competent.
The indecision between I don't want to betray
or
someone who's been good to me, and also I need to protect my family.
I think his most interesting aspect is the fact that he needs to protect his family. Adamant has this great kind of dynamic in this book where his family are being threatened by this shadowy organisation for most of the book, and this shadowy organisation go, right, here's your son's finger in a box, you're going to be a spy on Tamas for us. Anything you learn from him or anything you learn in investigations, you'll tell us and we won't hurt your family. And actually this gives Adamant a fairly decent amount of moral conflict. What's he going to do? I say that. He actually decides quite quickly, but then he feels bad about it. He's like, well, I'm going to protect my family. But there's still conflict there and he feels bad about it. And then he tries to help Tamas at the end.
So I mentioned that there was a dude who was claiming to be a god. This little plot is wrung out so slowly and so delicately that I was like, from the moment he shows up, I know he's not bullshitting. I know this guy is for real. He definitely is a god because there's no other reason for this scene to be written like this. But it still happens so slowly. The fact that this guy is just a divinity who's emerged into the world and is wandering around and all he wants to do is cook for people. That is so amusing and like just a little bit fun. I just really liked his presence.
This is a lovely little vignette, which I think what really works about this kind of story arc that's weaved throughout the rest of the novel is that it's not seemingly impacting anything else apart from it's making the church very angry, and it's building up that friction between the church and Tamas. And it's only when you get right near the end that you realize, oh, God's returning, one, is a thing, and two, is the main driving factor going forward. At least that's how this book leaves off. Like, oh no, this is actually what's happening. This is the main plot. I really like this character. Oh my God, now I'm struggling to remember a name. I'm saying it's not Krezimir. That's the god that establishes all the kings.
I don't know. I don't know what it is, Duncan. I put my phone away, so I can't look it up.
I know. I want to say it's... begins with an M. We're doing so bad today. Mahali,
right, yes. Mahali is like the god of good times, baby. He's like the Dionysus of this world. He likes to cook. He likes to sleep around. He had like 800 wives. And he was a real dude. Like, that's something that is expressed in the story by one of the Predii. He's just... a fella. He's out there. He was real. And Krezimir as well. He was a very powerful being. He came from another world, but he was tangible. And he walked around. And then one day, he left. And now that Krezimir's promise has been broken, that one of the lines for the first time in history has been severed, some of the Predii are summoning him back. And they're working with the enemy nation of Kez to bring about his return, and that's Tanyul's story. For the most of his book, Tanyul is perched on a mountainside, fighting an enemy army by just like shooting down the hill. His is like a prolonged war section. It's not an action scene. It's a series of shoved back like charges that he has to like hold back. But it culminates his section in like another mission, where he has to scale a mountain. He's discovered that they've crept past their line by digging under it. and he has to rush to the top of a mountain with his squad and take down the bad guys. And this section of the book just goes on for way too long. Way too long.
Now, I do love the chase up the mountain, the snow coming down, the monastery that's been blown up, like the monks at the top of that mountain in Skyrim. Also, I could not get the scale of this mountain down right, because when they get to the top, they like find an entire city in like a caldera at the top. I'm like, how big was this thing and how high that no one had come up here? Can you not see the top? Is this Olympus?
Well, if you think about it, it's like the late 1700s. We really hadn't started climbing like stuff like Everest back then.
No, I suppose you're right. But Everest doesn't have a city hidden up top.
Mountaineering is fairly modern as a hobby.
I'm sorry, we've jumped about so much. We're on Mali for a second. Right, yes. You say it goes on too long. I agree. I think we have some really cool action scenes early on with Tanil. But this scene... Now, I actually feel like the scene at the fort when he's trying to defend and drive back the enemy, you could almost write like a legend-style novel just set here. And
that's exactly what I was thinking of. And those scenes, they scratched the same itch as Legend. It just didn't have quite as many characters. You know, there were some fun characters around that is enjoyable to see and spend time with. But yeah, again, this is just another whole novel which would be enjoyable to read. And it's just a part of this omnibus that's been forced together like a magnet.
A good example of this is the fact with the characters of Bo and Gavril. Two people who are members of the Watch. Bo is the wizard that Tanil gets sent to deal with, and they don't. Anyway, that's for later. And like Bo has like a couple of girlfriends, and I don't know, I almost feel like I just wanted a scene where they were all, you know, after pushing the enemy back, they all went back to the tavern together and sat around the mess room drinking ale and having a chat. But we just don't
There's a scene that's almost that. Like there's a scene where they're sharing a bottle. And that's a really good chapter. I loved that chapter. But you're right, there could have been more scenes like that. They were just about the relationships of the people on the wall. But then you're asking for Legend again, but with guns. So I guess, like, the fantasy version of Zulu?
I would read that. Maybe in a shot. No, I actually saying that. Zulu has... Yeah, let's not go into that.
Then Duncan and Geordie spoke about Zulu for several minutes before deciding it was not worth putting in the podcast. The end.
Okay, back to the fantasy novel.
I just think like it could have breathed more. And that's the thing, there's so many elements in this book that I really enjoyed. But then sometimes, it's like, well, to make this section better, maybe it needs a bit more time. But I don't want it to take away from this other section, which I love even more. Likewise, this is a long book and I don't want more pages. So it's quite challenging. And like I said, this chase at the end, like this is the time of the model with Tanil where we get a lot. We get the Kapul age thing comes out at this point. And genuinely, I was mostly like, okay, you're going to run up the mountain and you're going to fight the big bad. Cool. Get on with it. I was getting really fed up, I'm not going to lie, with Tanil at this point.
And exactly. And that was the real problem. Like everything involving like the race up the mountain, here's how I thought it was going to go and how it felt it should go. They say, we have to get up that mountain. And there would be one chapter about racing up the mountain, how difficult it is, and maybe someone falls off a crevasse, and it's sad, but they have to keep going because it's so important. And then they arrive at the top, they maneuver through the city, and that's one chapter, and then one more chapter is the big confrontation. They find the bad guys, bang, 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 they have a big fight, there's a big showdown, there's a critical moment at the end, boom, end of the story. The problem is that has to weave between Tamash chapters and Adamat chapters, all of which span, like, have their own action scenes. And so, because of the pacing of the story, and he wants all of the climax to happen at once, Tanya's climax, which sort of gets kicked off first, is stretched out. There's all of these scenes of them pacing around and being scared about, like, oh no, the mountain cats are about. And then there's another chapter which is like, oh no, we're being chased by the mountain cats. Oh no, let's run. And there's a scene where they're like getting lost in the big building. And then there's the big confrontation. It's really stretched out. And I don't want to harp on it for too long, but it could have been so much briefer and more exciting if they had just cut out some of those Tanya chapters.
And I'm not saying
I'd like to talk about the final moment of the story.
Oh. Oh, what, when Tanil is recovering in the tent and he speaks to his father?
The penultimate part of the story, because we haven't actually said what happens.
Oh, you mean the bit when they kill God?
Yes. So, the bad guys are trying to resurrect... Well, not resurrect, he's not dead. They're trying to bring back Kresimir. And there's this bit where they... You know, the stakes of the scene is they need, like, a ton of privilege to be able to do it. And we can't possibly kill her, the Predi, because she's so powerful. But we can kill the privileged. And the more of them we kill, like, the more of a chance that we can just, like, prevent the ritual from occurring. And I like that. I really like the fact that it was, like, not direct confrontation. It was like, we have to fight around the problem. But that ultimately fails. They do manage to resurrect Kresimir. And as he's, like, descending from the heavens, Tanyol, like, from, I think, what is it, 3 miles away? They have said before, this is not that super crazy, because Tanyol has shot people who were literally a mile away in, like, it's mentioned in the lead-up to the book. This is, like, something he's famous for. But it's a ridiculous distance, even for a powder mage. And for context, 3 miles away at sea level is over the horizon.
Yep.
But he's elevated, so that's fine. Yeah, so with his super vision, he can see this tiny speck of a god descending from the heavens, and he lines up his shot, and despite the fact that it's an impossible shot and he can't possibly do it with the last of his power, he fires 2 bullets, and he shoots a god in the chest, and he's like, I did it, Karpol. I killed a god. And then the roof falls on them or something. And it very abruptly cuts to the epilogue. And it's such a jarring... We were just talking about the passage of time in it. The fact that it just suddenly ends and it's over. And then we're in the epilogue. And Tanyol and Karpol are like in a coma. Which is such a standard, like, easy way to get your heroes out of danger, is to just knock them out, but, like, really knock them out. Not dead, almost, you know.
I'm never a fan of this, the idea that they're, like...
Me neither.
Right in the heart of danger, and then they fall unconscious, and it's just like, yep, we got them back, they're in the safe tent. And they say, oh, you know, was it Bo carrying them down the mountainside? You're like... Yeah, that's an adventure in itself. What, as the volcano was erupting and the god was thrashing about and they were inside a collapsed building, not dead. You just got the bat well done.
A bit silly. Yeah, and Bo was like really messed up at the time. Like he was not doing well. But yes, he gets down through magic or whatever. And here's the thing. Why did he have Tanyol shoot Kresimir? Because you never buy it for a second that it means anything. Like, it's not a surprise when Bo's like, you can't kill a god. Like, we're like, yeah, obviously. Like, did the author really get us... Were we supposed to be hyped up to think like, yes, Tanyol, you can do it! You're the best around! No! Of course not!
In many respects, I think it would have given me a greater sense or more trepidation or excitement going into the next novel if it was like that scene in... Sorry, got to reference an anime now. You ever watched Bleach?
Have I watched Bleach, motherfucker? I've seen so much Bleach.
Okay, well, you know, episode 58, I think, roughly. There's this great scene where the main character's anime, guy called Ichigo, he's beating the big bad of, like, that story arc. And he's the biggest bad there's ever been. But then this new guy rocks up, and our main character, all souped up on his power, rushes towards him. The music is hyping us up. And then it does that great classic, the music just cuts out as the new big bad literally picks up his index finger and just catches his sword. And then just flicks our villain away. That's what I think I personally would have quite enjoyed in this sort of scene. If we'd seen our main character, he run up the stairs, he'd taken on all those privilege. You know, privilege we'd had been set up are a major threat in this world. And then, like, if he had that scene where he's like, right, I'm going to take down a god. And then the god could just, like, put up one hand and, like, just catch the bullets. something like that, I think I would have found like a bit more, here we go.
Yeah. Maybe the scene would be like he does this incredible shot and then he visually confirms it didn't work. And he can say to Karpal, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I thought I could kill a god. And then it collapses. I think that would have been more dramatic. And that would have been more fatalistic. Instead, it's this moment of, it feels like he's trying to imply that it's triumphant. Or maybe it's just like a really advanced version of dramatic irony. I'm not sure. Anyway, it doesn't last long because the next chapter they reveal it didn't work. It's the last line of the book, I think. And the last epilogue is really Tamas has gone back to his son's side. And he's like, you've got a war that's still continuing with Krezimir, with Kez, the opposing nation. It's not going to get any better. You need to prepare for the mother of all wars coming your way. And the gods are returning and they want to destroy the entire nation. Not just you. The entire nation needs to be destroyed. So now you're fighting for the survival of your people.
Intense. Do you want to know what happens next? I don't want to undersell that fact.
I really want to know. We've said some nasty stuff. And I really don't want people to forget all the nice things we said as well. Because on the whole, I really enjoy this book. 7 out of 10.
This is really solid. Like, we say 7 out of 10. This is 7 out of 10 for me in the way that parts of this book are 10 out of 10. Parts of this book are 5 out of 10. And the way it all meshes together is 6 or 7 out of 10.
Yeah, there's a couple of fours in there, like Karpal and that drags it down. But it's nothing that it can't recover from. I really think, like, I'm definitely going to read the next book. There's no question about it in my mind. But probably not on the podcast. We have so many books we need to read. I think, Duncan, that in terms of reading it for the podcast, we have given our opinion. We'll check back in at the start of an episode, maybe later down the line. But there's so many things that we have to do that I don't think we can afford time. It was your pick to do this. I'm telling you now, I really doubt what I'm going to pick. The Something Republic to be the next book we do.
Geordie, I completely understand. If, to be pretty honest, I'm a little bit relieved. I think this is something where I'm going to be happy to take a break. And the day I come and read the next book in the series, I will probably enjoy it. Hell, maybe it will change all around and I'll be like, Geordie, come back. We've got to do it. You've got to experience this. But when I'm sitting here and there's such great series that we haven't continued, see Scholomance, see all of Joe Abercrombie's work, I can't see this hitting the top of the pile.
Well, then, the question remains, what is next? And it's my decision, Duncan.
Oh, that is, Geordie. This is interesting. I feel, you know, this is nice and open. Where are we going to go? What are we going to do?
Now, unfortunately, Duncan, you see, I've been at work for about 2.5 weeks now, and I feel like it's time for me to go on another holiday. You know what? I'm just not feeling it. I'm going off again.
I relate so hard.
That's not a joke. It was framed as one, but no, I'm going off on a second holiday. I had a big summer holiday with a little gap of doing work in the middle of it. I am back in the UK for 2.5 weeks, and now I'm off to France. Not for the Olympics. That's done. I'm skipping that completely. But I am going to do some cool historical stuff. My girlfriend and I are going to Versailles, and we're also going to this amazing site called Gouédion. Have you heard of this, Duncan?
I have not heard of Gouédion.
Gouédion is a French historical construction project. It was begun in the 1990s, where French medievalists are building, using entirely medieval methods, an actual medieval castle.
That is so cool.
It has been about 30 years they've been building it. They built it next to a quarry, and they dig out all the stone themselves. They split the stone with historical methods. They chisel it with historical methods. They lift the stones. They even, like, lay levels using, like, a pendulum instead of, like a level with a bubble in it. I think the one thing that they do is they wear hard hats because they still live, you know, in an actual real-life modern democracy where we don't make workers wear jerkins.
See, Jordy, you could actually just leave it the phrase, because they still live. Thus need a hard hat. Yeah.
And one more thing is that they do, where they still live, is that they only build it during the spring and summer. In the winter, they just close it down. They're like, the peasants are going home because you do not build castles in the winter.
Obviously, Geordie. I mean, we all know that. Well, I hope you really enjoy your trip, Geordie. You can really get in touch with those themes of revolution that were kicked off
by this
book.
Yes. I'm going to buy one of those red hats they've been showing so many times at the Olympics. Also, I'm going to a place called, and I'm going to mispronounce this because my girlfriend and I can't figure out how it's actually pronounced. It's either Peur de Feu or Peur de Feu. It's a French medieval theme park that has like chariot racing and jousting. And apparently there's going to be a part in the jousting where the French knights are all jousting and it's all good fun. And then the English show up and everyone boos. And I'm going to cheer for him. Hooray! We lost the Euros, but we're going to win the joust.
I absolutely love that. Honestly, medieval reenactments are such good fun. Jousting reenactments. Like, I think if they were to bring jousting back as with a sport, I'd watch that. It's fucking
entertaining. Oh, hell yes. Well, that's me.
Yeah,
that's my plan.
Fun. I'm just working.
And in the meantime, what I meant to say is, whilst I'm out there, I'm going to be reading, and so are you, Duncan, The Priory of the Orange Tree.
Oh, this has been on my to-read list for a very long time. It is
mine
a
too.
Very big book, and I think that's why I've never had enough time between podcast reads to sort of fit it in. So I'm very happy you've picked it, because it needs that level of dedication.
I don't really know what it's about. I bought it as part of a 2-for-1 deal with Kirky. I know that it's about dragons. I know it has beautiful cover art. It has Eastern and Western dragons. And I think there are lesbians in it, but that's all I know.
I think I know a little bit more. I believe, and I might be completely wrong here, it's a fantasization of the period in Japanese history where they pursued isolationism as a concept to stave off Western influence.
I can't remember what it's called again. It's like a 300-year period where they just closed the country.
I'm glad they opened their borders. But it seems like a very nice place to visit.
I want to go skiing now.
Sorry, is that another holiday you're just dropping in on me? That's just so you know, I'll be off after that. I'll be back for 1 week. We can record an episode and then I'm off again.
The only holiday I actually have planned out is in 2 years' time, which is that I want to go hiking in Spain during the total solar eclipse.
Well, that sounds like immense fun. But back to the podcast. I look very much forward to reading The Priory of the Orange Tree with you, Geordie, and discussing it in 2 weeks. As always, it's been a pleasure. If you have read The Priory of the Orange Tree or Promise of Blood or any of the other books we have read or are yet to read on this podcast, please reach out to us. Let us know your thoughts. You can reach out to us at our Instagram, It's Just Fantasy Podcast, or you can email us on Gmail, itsjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com. Always great to have questions. We do respond to everyone. We had a great question on our Gmail the other day that we really look forward to answering in a future episode, maybe even a full-blown bonus, because I'm not going to lie. I read this question, I was like, this speaks to my like special interest. I can nerd out for ages over this. So look forward to another bonus episode coming eventually, hopefully this year. That's a promise.
This year, I can promise that. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
So long.
Bye.